every single day, every time I think about this, I get goosebumps.
Yeah.
The fact that what has turned out to be my work, at least for the last decade, was catalyzed by almost a car crash, a literal crash course into what would become the rest of my life. I think that too often we don't take the clues. We don't stay open to the magic that's available around us all the time, because that was magic.
Agree. Welcome back, my friends, to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Kefauver. We're all just briefly, perfectly human. That's the profound reminder from our guest today, Alua Arthur. If we are brave enough to allow this truth to be at the center of our awareness in our day-to-day lives, Alua argues we could live a fuller, more compassionate, and even magic-filled existence. In our conversation today, and in her adventure-filled and beautifully honest memoir, Briefly Perfectly Human, she helps us see how we can make an authentic life by getting real about the end. Arthur is a death doula, recovering attorney, in her words, and the founder of Going With Grace, a death doula training and end-of-life planning organization that exists to support people as they answer the question, what must I do to be at peace with myself so that I may live presently and die gracefully? Going With Grace works to improve and redefine the end-of-life experience for people rooted in every community, using the individual lived experience as the foundation. Alua's warmth and wisdom and wit and passion for living, even while keeping the end in mind, is an inspiration to me, and I know you will feel the same way after today's episode. Well, this has been a while in the making, my friend. Welcome, Alua Arthur, to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. I'm already just giggling because I see your big smiling face. I love it.
Thank you, Lisa. I'm giggling too, and we've already been giggling a bit, and I'm so excited that we get to finally talk today.
I know. Well, listeners heard at the top of the show as if they didn't already know you, but if in case they didn't, they heard at the top of the show all the amazing work that you've already put out into the world and a little teaser about your incredible book. Y'all, I love the show because I get to sneak preview books before they come live. They're going to be in your bookstore April 16th if you're listening to this before then, but you can also always pre-order it if you do. Briefly, Perfectly Human. Alua Arthur, a death doula. You all, I'm going to drop the links in the show notes. So just do yourself a favor and get yourself that copy. Yeah, but I'm just thrilled to be in conversation with you today. And we're going to explore your incredible life that is full of so much richness. And as we were talking about off the air, like sees like, we both are people who just, for some reason or other, decide to take it all on all at once.
Deep breaths.
Exactly. But I mean, your subtitle of the book, I really feels telling about the you that I've gotten to know a little bit in person and then through reading the book, which is making an authentic life by getting real about the end. And I do believe that that shows up in how you are in the world, including this fullness and this richness and the taking on all the things.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you for that reflection and that feedback.
Yeah, yeah. So we are going to dive deep into the book today, into your story about what you've all these different transformations that you've gone through in your life and transitions. But I wanted to ground us where I do with every guest, and that's really helping us anchor into where our grief beliefs came from. We can't know how we want to walk through our grief unless we know the beliefs that we have packed in our suitcases and come with us along the way. So I ask you what I ask all my guests, which is, can you think back to an early memory of loss in your childhood, probably, or young adulthood? And how were the adults in your life modeling grief explicitly, implicitly? What do you think you learned from that in an early experience?
The first loss I recall, didn't feel like mine directly because I wasn't very familiar with her, but it was my mother's mother, my grandmother, Kate Akwa. And I was 5 when she died. We left Ghana when I was 3.5, and she lived in Ghana. And so around the time that I started to form memories, she wasn't a part of my memories necessarily. I just remember when she died. I remember my mom's sadness. I remember there was like a blanket over the house, I felt like, at least emotionally.
Yeah.
I remember that she was vocal about how she was feeling. It was one of the few times that I saw my mom cry in my childhood and adolescence. Mm. But I remember seeing her cry. I remember holding her hand as we were walking into the funeral, which was held in Ghana. I remember there was like openness around grief. Ghana is an expressive country. We express a lot of things. We certainly express grief as well. And so I got to see that then. So I think early I had some messaging that it was okay to be sad about something big that happens.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. As you can imagine, over these past 5 seasons, I've got quite a mix of answers, but I would say on the whole, again, although I've been interviewing a lot of people sort of raised in the Western culture, a lot of people, especially if they were young, they weren't allowed to go to the funeral. They weren't allowed to talk about it when they brought it up. You know, this topic was changed, or they were told anger wasn't okay or sadness wasn't okay. And so I love to hear that you're early experience was one I think we would all hope for ourselves, which is this kind of like normalizing and naming this thing 100% of us are going to go through and experience.
Yeah. She was sad that her mother had died. I think she also had a complex relationship with her mom, but I still remember her sadness. And I remember feeling like, oh, this is a big deal. I don't know why, but it's very important to her.
Yeah. Well, we're probably going to touch on this later, but you just brought up sort of the fact that sometimes we lose people that we've had a complex and complicated relationship with, and that means sometimes our grief is complex, or that sometimes even if it was a very complicated or contentious relationship, the loss isn't really a loss per se. And I think even that's important to name in our grief culture, because we do tend to like lionize and put people up on pedestals, and we feel this pressure to grieve some losses that don't feel like a loss.
Majorly. Yeah. And also all the different expressions of grief that don't look like the ones that we expect them to.
Exactly.
For example, when the Queen of England died, and there were some people that were celebrating, you know, the country was in mourning, but there were people within the country that were not mourning. There were people that were dancing and making jokes. And it's also an expression. It was like, a death has occurred, and this is how I feel about the death. This is how I'm processing that loss. Yeah. And so it didn't look like we expect, but it was still a strong expression of grief, I think.
Absolutely. And to your point, just making space for it all. It's not just, and especially, I think the only thing we're even allowed sort of is sadness, let alone that there's anger and sorrow and bitterness and confusion and resentment and celebration sometimes, because that loss represented a very harmful relationship, as I think is in the case there. So I do feel that in many ways we have this kindred spirit of really expanding and opening up what it means to be human and to experience these things that 100% of us, you know, it's my favorite party opening line. 100% of us are going to experience grief, just like you, right? Like, we're all going to die. Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
I'm Alua. You're going to die.
You're going to die.
What do you want to talk about today?
Yeah. The roofer who just came over to check out the roof. We just dove right in, had a nice long conversation about death. It was really sweet.
I love it. Well, again, I think that's something that we share. And so many of us, I think, probably a lot of listeners to this show, is when you are faced with, whether it's your own or to be a witness, which is a lot of what your experience is, to the end of somebody's life, the sort of superficialities of life seem like such a waste of time often. Not that we don't all maybe love to get into some goss or, you know, do something, but yeah, to just drop really into the important stuff. That's the preciousness of our time together.
The goss is also kind of sweet.
I mean, the goss is fun sometimes, depending on what it is, but yeah.
Yeah.
So I was trying to think about, where do we even begin? And I do this when I'm being interviewed too. It's like, I'm 52. How do I even? And in the beginning, you're right, I was born. But I think maybe since we started with the story about your mother losing her mother and going back to the funeral in Ghana. I wondered if you wanted to walk us through a little bit, because you open your book in that way too, about you and your sisters being raised here in the States, being raised in a mostly white community, the sort of cultural landscape. Tell us a little bit about young you and sort of when you look back, how did that shape even this work that you're doing today or who you are today?
When I look back with so much compassion for young me. In the acknowledgments of my book, I remember sitting down being like, wow, like there's a lot of people I want to thank, but I also just really want to thank and hold young me who was trying her best, you know, who was in this new country. Granted, we traveled a lot in my early childhood, but when we settled in the States, I was 11 and we were in a super white community. I'd never been around so many white people before. They were mostly black and brown, and they were also like all different races because we were missionaries. And so everywhere we went, there was people of all races that were celebrating Jesus. But when we ended up in Colorado Springs, all of a sudden it was like all white. There were Latino folks, but they were on the south side of town. We were on the north side. So I didn't know anybody else other than white people mostly. And I, aside from just my race, I think the way that I wanted to approach the world or the things that I was curious about. I mean, don't get me wrong. I was a big New Kids on the Block fan.
I mean, you were still living in, you know, 1980s, whatever.
Yeah.
America culture.
Early 90s, middle
early
America.
Early 90s. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I was still down and Alanis Morissette. But also I started learning about other things and I was really curious. I'd read Roots very young. And so I was like, well, where do I learn more about that? And where are the people that are talking about art and culture and the stars and physics? And I wanted to go deep. And I also had this big bleeding heart that my heart was broken about everything. And so I would just follow those things to the end. And so in my book, I thanked the very young version of me who was riding her Marvin the Martian skateboard around the town, trying to get people to sign up for a recycling drive before recycling was like even cool, and like trying to collect cans. And people, if they opened the door at all, said no. And I just kept riding. And I just want to hold her and say, we're okay, kid. We're okay. We're okay. We're okay. We did okay.
I love that. I talk often on the show, but I just, when you had that, I had like visceral reaction of that, like speaking to those parts of us, especially those young parts of us who maybe were told we were too much or too loud or too noisy or too inconvenient to people. And I love that even as you thought about your acknowledgments that you were like placing your hand over your heart, even as you did that and were telling that story, and to just really embrace that. And I think more of us would benefit if we really spent some time looking with kindness. I think so much we think times when it's time to interrogate or go into therapy, we have to like pick apart and like, you know, criticize all these parts of us that got us into maybe some behaviors in our adult life that we don't want to keep. Some of us anyways, you know, and those parts of us were those people because of the things that they experienced. And I believe, and there's a lot of beauty there. So I love that you just modeled that for us. That's beautiful.
I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah.
I also just feel, you know, there was so much confusion and so much trying to like make sense of the world and my world and my inner world and my emotional experience, like you were just saying, feeling like I was too much or I didn't fit in or quiet this down or be less black or be less this or be more of that. And I was just like, I don't know how to do any of that. Like, I know how to do this. And so I'm going to try to do that as best as I can. Obviously, I made a lot of compromises to be able to get by, but now I don't have to anymore because I'm an adult.
There's a lot of downsides to adulting, but there are some amazing upsides, and that's one of them. When we give ourselves permission, right, to be the fullest expressions of ourselves, which many of us don't in adulthood, right?
Yeah,
it sometimes takes some big pivotal event for us to recognize, oh, wait, I'm actually not living to my true purpose or to my true passion or really in alignment with who I am. And oftentimes, unfortunately or fortunately, it's a death or an illness or a tragedy or something that kind of wakes us up and shakes us into that. And I know you stumbled that way, as that's part of the story of how you ended up becoming the death doula that we all know. But speaking of sort of getting into adulthood and doing things that maybe we think we should do, you were, some people may or may not know, a lawyer for a good amount of time. I'm imagining, again, things is, tell us a little bit about that path. And when you think about how did that fit or not with the thoughtful, sensitive young girl that you were just describing, and how did you end up on the path? And then a little bit of the story, maybe even in Cuba or whatever, about how you veered off that path, which I love. Yeah.
You know, even after writing 72 pages, I'm still like, how did that happen? How did that happen? And I think what happened was that I was bright. I was talented and gifted. I excelled according to every metric. My brain makes connections in quick ways that I had nothing to do with. Right. I did well in college. And it was like, I want to do the next thing. I'm not ready to choose what I want to do for my career, but I know it has to be something in advocacy somehow. I want to impact change somehow. My dad said, well, you could try politics. And we were all like, that will never work. It will never work. I put my foot in my mouth way too often to be a politician. I'm not diplomatic enough. Be a teacher. I was like, I don't think I have the patience to care for other people's kids and to teach them in that way, which the joke's on me because I teach now, but that aside, not children, but still.
Yeah.
But so law school seemed to make the most sense at the time. I was miserable in law school. I didn't want to actually go to law school. I just wanted to do the thing with the law degree that I was eventually going to be able to do, which hoped was policy or some direct services, some grassroots direct services. And so when I graduated, I worked at the Legal Aid Foundation of Los Angeles. I got to work with people, low-income people in their government benefits cases and their domestic violence cases, and then worked with community leaders to build art schools in low-income neighborhoods in LA. And through it all grew really, really depressed. The depression was the catalyst that started to shift the trajectory of my life. And to this day, I am so grateful for it. It was hard staying alive during that
grateful time. Grateful for the depression. Yeah. Yeah. Say more about that.
It was like an agitator cycle to my life, to my spirit, to my soul, to my work, to just everything, because it forced me, first of all, to step off of the working track because I was so depressed that I could no longer go to work, deemed so by my doctors. So it allowed me to step off the track. But it also forced me so deeply inward that the only place to go was like to take a solid look at who I'd become and to take a look at how we got here. I was a shell of a human. I was a shell of myself. My body was thin. I couldn't find any joy. I couldn't find any purpose. I didn't get what I was doing here. And I couldn't understand how other people did so effortlessly, it seemed anyway.
Yeah,
I hid a lot of my depression. I didn't talk to a lot of people about it. People could tell I was getting skinny, but you know, in this culture, we celebrate
it. They celebrate that. Yeah.
Yeah. So they were like, good job. And I was like, oh no, I'm not eating.
This is a sign you guys aren't paying attention to. Yeah.
Exactly. I don't want anybody to ever confuse me with a bitch who doesn't eat. Okay. I eat. I like to eat. So when
I'm not, that's a sign.
There's something wrong.
Yeah.
Being skinny for me, I was sick. I was very, very ill. And I kept with it. I started doing more and more inquiry, went really deep within, started meditating. And through my meditation, decided to go to Cuba. That's a short version of the story.
Yeah.
There was a lot of synchronicity that led me there.
And there was a lot of synchronicity while you were there.
A lot of synchronicity while I was there.
Reading that again, kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about, was it Jessica?
Jessica. Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that synchronicity and bumping into her and how that maybe started to crack open? Maybe why your depression had shown up, as you said, in this way as this gift and how it started to change.
Absolutely.
Your course. Yeah.
So when I'm in Cuba, I'm in this town called Trinidad, which is the oldest town in Cuba. And I've been partying really hard all night long. Woke up in the morning late. I had to get to the bus. And because I was leaving for Santiago de Cuba on the other side of the island that day, and I wanted to return something to somebody I'd met earlier on. So I was running through the town, still intoxicated from the night before, and a car almost hit me. And I slammed my hands on the hood, like the car came that close. I like scooted back. It was probably an inch away from me or so. And all of my senses were immediately alert. It was a very, very, very close call. After that, I went to the bus station and I start chatting with somebody who is in line who offers to hold my bags for me so that I can get on the bus that I want to get on. She made a fool of herself while doing so because I was watching her through the window and I was so tickled that this human was trying so hard to get me on the bus. I didn't quite get it. But I sat down on the last seat. We talked. We had a lovely time. I learned that she had uterine cancer and she was traveling to see the top six places in the world she wanted to see before she died. And I was stunned.
Like, how old, remind me, how old were you at this time about?
34.
Okay.
And she was 36.
Right. So, you're looking at a peer. Yeah.
And she's talking about dying? What? How? Don't get me wrong. In all my education, obviously, I understood that people died, but it never really landed in my body.
And especially someone who's your age, like that it could happen to us.
Especially somebody who's traveling just like I, you know, who's curious about the world just like I. What do you mean she has a serious disease that could kill her? And wow, now she's really grappling with her mortality, which was a beautiful conversation that we got into. I asked her a lot of questions about her life, about her ideas about death, about her fears, about what she still wanted to do with her time. I still don't understand where I got the hubris to ask a stranger these questions, but I did. Yeah. And I'm glad I did, because during that conversation, a lot opened up around what she wanted to do with herself and her life. And then it helped me see that if I were to die from the disease of depression, which is absolutely a terminal illness when left untreated, I did not like the life that I'd had thus far. And I didn't want that to be how I died. I wanted to die having lived a life that felt authentic and true and good to me, not the
on paper life that,
you know, that sounded good, but felt like shit.
Yeah, which so many of us have had those patches. And for some of us, it's been, you know, most of our lives.
Yeah. For many people, I think. Yeah. I find it so often in my clients, they're reaching the end, like, well, damn, I thought I was going to do it at some point, but now here we are. So the time on the bus with Jessica was really beautiful. The thing that really, the beautiful synchronicity of it all is that when we eventually got off the bus together 14 hours later, I learned that she was in the car that had almost hit me.
I know.
And
when I read that, I like put down, like I practically threw down the book. I was like, what?
Every single day, every time I think about this, I get goosebumps.
Yeah.
The fact that what has turned out to be my work, at least for the last decade, was catalyzed by almost a car crash, a literal crash course into what would become the rest of my life. I think that too often we don't take the clues. We don't stay open to the magic that's available around us all the time, because that was magic.
Agree.
Absolutely.
I agree it was magic, and I agree that is something that many of us don't do enough of. We keep the aperture of our view and our lens kind of close in, and we are just trying to get from one thing or one goal or one metric to the next, and we're not open to the synchronicities that are invitations to, because synchronicities like that require you to pause. And I don't think we're so good at pausing.
No.
Because the pausing and the stillness also is where we can start to bubble up that younger version of us, or the part of us that always dreamed of something and that takes wrestling with, which again, we just want to get, you know,
to the next thing.
To the next.
Yeah. Without ever pausing to think about what utter magic it is that we are breathing oxygen that we can't see. Somehow through some system, it enters into these bodies.
And you don't even have to think about it. That's the crazy thing. It happens
all the time.
Whenever I guide somebody through meditation and we focus on a breath, I'm like, you know, this is the first time you thought about your breath today, but your body's been doing this the whole day.
Like, and all night.
And all night. And since the day you were born, like
all the
magic.
Time. Yeah. Unless, of course, you have a lung disease and you start thinking about it.
Exactly. Right.
But otherwise, we're just moving along and it's magic. Along. All of this is magical. It's just so wild to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have this magical encounter with Jessica again, goosebumps. You found that, as you said, hubris, or I think it was sort of a divine intervention for you to really get back to something core to who you were. And now your wheels are spinning about this whole way of seeing
the preciousness of life, the conversations around death. And I don't think it was right from Cuba, but when you returned, is that when you got the news about your brother-in-law?
Yeah.
Or was it that trip? Or
no, during that trip, he was okay. Everybody was okay. Like when I went back to New York after the trip, because that's where I'd flown in from. And everybody was okay. And I started talking about death and people were like, what are you talking about? And don't get me wrong. I did not have an aha moment, come to Jesus. Right. This is my life's work.
Yeah.
I just found something that interested me enough. Yeah. And I kept turning it over and over again in my head. I wanted to talk about it more. I wanted to ask questions. I was curious if other people were thinking about this all the time. Turned out they're not. Surprise. I don't understand how.
I don't either. But
the only thing I think about, aside from food and sex. And so it was stunning to me that I had fixated on this. It just dug its claws in. So I started reading books and talking to people. And then my brother-in-law got sick. And I was like, oh, well, I'm reading all these books about death. But we were not talking about death then because he was going to get cured and he was going to fight.
And as you said, that whole fight.
He was going to live. He was going to fight. And so we were fighting.
Yeah.
We were fighting. And then at some point, his body did not respond well to the medicine.
When we come back, Ilua shares how the spark that started in her near-crash encounter with Jessica in Cuba turned out to be the wisdom she needed to show up for her family, including her brother-in-law, in his final days. You're listening to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Kiefhaver. Friends, I got the sweetest note the other day from a listener. Oh, my heart. Patricia emailed me at info@lisakiefhaver.com to say this. I wanted to let you know that I pre-ordered your book and I'm excited for it to be published. You don't know this, but you and I walk together most every day through the joy of your podcasts. And I finally figured out how to leave a 5-star review. Though you are deserving of far more than just 5 stars. Thank you for being a healing presence in the grief world. I cannot tell you how much her note meant to me, how much it means to me every time I see a new 5-star rating, read a kind review, and get notes like these in my inbox. Hosting this show is absolutely 100% a highlight of my life. And yet, since I don't do them live yet, I don't always hear how it impacts the audience. So please take a few minutes after the show today, head to Apple Podcasts or Spotify, follow the show, then click all 5 stars to leave a rating, and click that pen button to write a review about what the show has meant to you. Also, I'm thinking about getting a voicemail set up so you can leave me questions to answer on the show from time to time. Would you like that? Friends, we are just over 2 months away from my book, Grief is a Sneaky Bitch, An Uncensored Guide to Navigating Loss, hitting bookstores. Oh my God. Actually, this week, I'm in the studio recording the audiobook version, and it has been so much fun to do. I really feel like I'm talking directly to each and every one of you. There are 3 things to know about the book release. 1, you don't have to wait. You can pre-order it now on Amazon or your favorite online bookseller. And when you do, message me on Instagram or info@lisakiefhaver.com to get an invite to my fabulous Zoom pre-launch party on my birthday, May 22nd. And 2, I'm removing the distance between the screen and mic by hitting the road starting publication day, June 4th. I'm adding cities all the time, but I'm starting here in San Diego, and then heading to Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, Boston, and of course my hometown, Ann Arbor. Go Blue! To find out if I'm coming to a city near you, sign up for my not-so-regular newsletter. And 3, you know by now I love being in conversation. That's why at each of my book stops, I will be in conversation with a favorite author, many of whom you have heard on this show, like Melissa Gould, author of Widowish, Steph Jagger, author of Everything Left to Remember, and so many more. I can't wait to meet you, hug you, answer your questions, and of course, take those selfies together. We can share them on Instagram at Lisa Kefauver MSW.
And so I went out to New York where he was again with my sister and my niece. And I got to spend the last 2 months of his life with him. And what a gift also.
What a gift. Tell us a little bit about Peter. What should we know to carry on Peter's legacy?
Wow. Peter was the most like unassuming, but tall. He was big in stature, gregarious, silly, really principled, so righteous, but righteous in the different way that I was righteous. So we would fight all the time and we were both very right about what we were saying. I'm still right. I'm still right. But he's dead and he can't argue with me anymore. Sorry, Peter. Yeah. He was lovely. He was great. He was married to my sister. My sister is such a strong personality and he loved her just as he was. And I was so happy about that. Yeah. I loved Peter. We became friends very quickly. He came into my life when I was 21 and he stayed and I grew up with him kind of. He became like a brother to me. I adored Peter.
Yeah.
And so when he's dying,
again, similar ish age. Again, here you are confronted with, you know, somebody not at the, what we think of as at the end of their life, meaning they've made it to their 80s or 90s. He was in his
40s.
The 40s? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He was in his 40s. He was older than I, almost 10 years, I think.
Yeah.
9 years. And I would always tease him for it because he seemed ancient to me, but not old enough to be dying.
Right. It's different. Knew. Yeah. Yeah. Ancient, like you're not hip, but not like you're ready to die.
He was not hip. Okay. He was not hip. Bless his heart. So I got to be with him as he was dying. And, you know, even today, memory of him just makes my heart feel all soft and squishy. Like, what a human. What a gift to be in his life, to get to love him, to have loved him in that way, to keep his memory alive in this way too, feels really great.
Yeah, I love that. When I can, pretty much every episode and wherever I go, I really try, of course, I'm inviting people to talk often about the story of how someone they love died, but it just is equally important to me, if not more, is to model the conversations that we have about asking them about how they lived and how they continue to live in our memories and in the stories we tell, because I think so often people don't bring up the person's name because they think it's going to make the griever upset. And I'm like, the griever is thinking about the person. Now they just don't think you are. So I love to offer that. And I'm glad you got to share Peter, oh, by the way, in his fullness, even in his righteousness and his stubbornness. And we know we don't always have to just glorify the amazing things about the person, but I love that. Tell me, I can't remember now, so I apologize, but were you physically there when Peter passed?
Or I was.
Yes. And was that the first time you had been with somebody when they died? Yeah.
It was. He was my first impactful death of like somebody I knew.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was the first one. And I was in the room when he died at the witching hours. And I was in awe of him, you know?
Yeah.
Of what he had just done, because it had been, he'd been unconscious for days. He'd been sick for 6 months. And the labor of him dying was like, gosh, he is working. And there's a whole process going on right now, never knew anything about. I was so in awe of Peter.
Yeah. Well, I asked that because, you know, I think for some people listening, obviously a lot of our listeners to the show maybe have had someone passed, some have or haven't been with them. But many people I've crossed paths with over my career of doing this work, I could never be there with somebody, or I couldn't do it, or it's got to be so hard or so scary. And I've now was with my husband when he passed, although he was in a coma. And then a few years later with my friend Joe when he passed, and he was awake and was able to tell me goodbye, and I was able to tell him goodbye in a way that I didn't get to be. I'm going to get choked up, you know, with Eric. I think getting to be with him was a gift just for its own giftness because of our friendship, but also he was able to give me something that I didn't get to have with Eric when he passed. You know, he said, Joe said, it's time for me to go, Lisa. And I said, I know, I'm okay. I love you. I'm here. And he said, no, you don't understand. It's time for me to go. And
time
I said,
go.
I understand. You know,
I got it.
And so I just wanted to ask that experience of, because obviously you've now been with people in your work as a death doula, but I think there's, I think what some people don't understand, and you shared in your book, if, how do you feel about me reading a
oh, please.
From your book? There's something that you said in there that I think I want to make sure our listeners understand is the beauty and the intimacy around dying and death and even the help that we will all receive when we're in that, in those final moments. And it's one of the, if you're watching on YouTube, you can see a little, the whole book is just tagged and flagged, but this was one that really stood out to me. You said, some of us go our entire lives without surrendering to help. Many of my clients are self-made islands by the time I get to meet them. Sometimes as a death doula, I get to be the message in the bottle that washes ashore, telling them it's never too late to extend a hand into the empty space before you, daring to ask for help. Dying is the most intimate act we will undertake. It requires us to be intimate with ourselves, our bodies, our lives, and with the present moment, to reveal the parts we believe are difficult to love, the face beneath the mask we wear for the outside world, and the squishy parts that bear wounds and form scars. Everything else is a show. To be helped is to die a small death of the ego, but to allow love in as an invitation to allow our messy human glory to take front stage and let love pour into those places that have been beaten down by the ego and the outside world. Beautiful. Just, oh, this is going to make me tear up again. So damn tears. Peter, was your first time being with someone who died, but you've gone on to create a career of being a death doula. Not just that, of course, you speak and train and do other things, but as you've continued to show up in these intimate spaces to that passage or to your experience with Peter, what have you learned? What do you need to, what do you want us to know about the intimacy of being there for the person dying, for the person attending, the role of asking for receiving help as an act of love?
More and more, I tune into the incredible honor it is to get to witness a human. And, you know, that's available all the time. It's available at the gas station or it's available everywhere. Yet while somebody is dying, being able to be there with them in their vulnerability with all the things that they've shared that they still wanted to do or haven't yet done, or any regrets or sadness or forgiveness, or just even the messy kitchen that they didn't want to leave that way. It is hard not to fall in love with people when they reveal themselves. It inspires greater compassion in me overall, just as a human. And it allows me to extend that into people and places and situations that I don't understand. You know, I think compassion is really possibly the most healing force on this planet. Mm-hmm. I think if we can honor the individual for exactly who they are, despite whether or not I can understand or agree, if I can just honor them and give them their agency, you know, allow them to just be who they are, I really don't think that we would have mass deaths. I don't think that oppression can exist. I don't think that white supremacy can exist. Homophobia, transphobia, none of those things could exist if we honored the individual life. And that's what death companioning really keeps revealing to me, is look at the human, honor the human for exactly what their ride was, whether or not I get it, whether or not I agree.
Yeah.
That's everything.
It is everything. And 100% agree with you on this notion that if we really dropped into compassion, which is not pity, which is not sympathy, right? It's not an othering. In fact, it's the opposite of the othering. It is the belonging. It is the, I see your humanity and my humanity, right? In that way, we would be living in a different world. I too wonder, because you have shown up over and over again for people, though you are maybe showing up for people with, on paper, very different lived experiences, race, economics, part of the country, politics, work. Are there some common, as you said, come to Jesus, kind of like, are there some common queries or regrets or reflections or thoughts that you can think about as you think back over the folks that you've attended to or been with?
A lot of people want to talk about their relationships. A lot of people want to make sure that their relationships are in good shape with their family members, biological and chosen, with their partners, with their lovers, with their pets. It's the humans, it's the other beings that journey alongside us that seem to really be the thing that catches people and people want to hold on to as they're dying. Yeah. One of the major contemplations of dying, this is based on the 9 contemplations of death by an 11th century Buddhist scholar named Atisha. One of them is number 8, my loved ones cannot save me when death comes. It's something I must walk into alone. Granted, we have a lot of support and in some belief systems, the dead come to greet the dying, etc. Yeah. But it's something that we must walk into alone. And so I think with the awareness that this is an individual journey I'm taking, people are really looking to those that they love, the people that journeyed alongside them, recognizing that they have to leave them. And ouchie, ouch, 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 ouch. Yeah. Leave their community, leave this whole place that they, the only place that they've ever known.
The memories, the dreams, the everything.
Everything. There's a lot of grief involved in dying as well. I think we often think of grief for those that are still living.
Yeah.
But for the person that's dying, they got to leave everything behind. I'm losing you. You are losing everything. Wowee. Yeah.
Talk about anticipatory grief. That's the biggest, right? That is, nobody is experiencing it more than that person that's dying, that's conscious of dying. Yeah.
Pretty massive. Pretty massive. Yeah.
Well, that's such an interesting and important point. And I can't remember who I was having this conversation with the other day, but to your point, we can show up and bear witness and be with the person that is dying. The person that is dying, as you said so beautifully in the book, can open themselves up to help, which is in essence opening themselves up to love. And yet, the dying, we come into this world alone, by the way. Then we spend our whole life trying to build relationships and be in belonging, because that is our actual human drive. Forget Maslow's hierarchy of need, right? Is for belonging. And we work to be in relationship, and then we're walking out on our own, right, at the end, which is another reason in my mind, to your point, is to turn then back towards the person at the gas station, the person at the store, your sister, your brother, your uncle, your whoever, and to be present to the being with people, because this is the only shot we get to do it, as far as we know. I mean, yeah. You know, that's the only one I know about for this lifetime. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the only one I'm present to and aware of.
Yeah.
And also, like, turn into the 12-year-old in Pakistan.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, like, what are their experiences are so vastly different than mine. Can I hold compassion for them? Can I hold curiosity for them? Can I be, like, recognize that their lives have value also, even though it doesn't touch mine at all, as far as I know? Yeah. Like, I think it could extend into the entire world.
100%.
If only we were willing to exercise it. Consistently. Yeah.
I absolutely think it can. And for some people where that feels so far out of reach, I often guide people through a compassion meditation. Then I just say, start closer in, right? So start with the person at your church that you kind of know but don't know, or the person in your community that you pass by every day who is maybe unhoused. Like, start closer in.
Yeah.
In a way that can feel more palpable. But it is or I'm curious in your mind, but to me, it's a practice, because everything about the way in which our systems and culture are built is to not do that, which just means everything we're good at, by the way, we do a million times, right? Like, this is the practice of life.
It is such a practice.
Yeah.
It is such a practice. Listen, the person I was talking to, trying to get my car insurance yesterday, was helping me practice it. Okay. I had exactly. to be in my compassion, because I was like, I don't understand what the issue is, but for some reason, this is taking 18 times as long as I thought it should. So let me just
drop into,
I don't know what is going on with you today. I can't imagine what that would be, but it's something big. It must be.
I so appreciate your honesty about that, because that's the thing. It's like, it's easy to do something. This is what I say about like asking for help or receiving for help or taking big leaps in life. It's easy to do something. My motto, dive in and breathe deep and buddy breathe when necessary. When the circumstances are beautiful, when it's a kumbaya kind of a ceremony and we're all just imagining that we're holding the world in compassion. But when someone is confronting us in some way, that triggering us, as they say, or it feels like they're in antagonistically in our lives, that's when the rubber meets the road around your practice, right? And that's where you have to really dig hard and dig deep.
Hard.
When we come back, Eluwa traces the journey she's been on since sitting with her brother-in-law to the place she is now. As the founder of Going with Grace, a death doula training and end-of-life planning organization that exists to support people as they answer the question, what must I do to be at peace with myself so that I may live presently and die gracefully? I'm your host, Lisa Kefauver. You're listening to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. You may have heard that I took a break from taking on new individual clients in 2023. As I navigated breast cancer treatment, I did, however, continue to see former clients on a drop-in basis. As I move into the final phase of my treatment and am feeling stronger, I'm happy to say, I'm opening just a few spots for new clients soon. I'm offering a 6-session package that is ideal for newly grieving individuals facing all kinds of loss, death, illness, divorce or relationship ending, major life transitions, and more, or individuals further down the road who are looking for specialized grief care as a supplement to other therapeutic supports. Over our time together, you will feel held and cared for, have a chance to tap inward to discover your existing skills and resources, discover some of the barriers or shoulds getting in your way, cultivate a mindfulness practice essential for easing suffering, identify your emerging needs as a griever, and begin to build the community of support you will need as you continue on your journey. After you complete your 6-session package, you will be considered an existing client and qualified to sign up for check-in and tune-up sessions as available. Open enrollment periods happen only a few times per year. To learn more and reserve your spot today, after the show, visit lisakefauver.com/support. Grief isn't on a schedule, and neither is my newsletter. That's why I call it the not-so-regular newsletter. Still, from time to time, I drop into your inbox with a new essay, a writing prompt or practice for you, news about my book and book tour, and sometimes behind-the-scenes scoops about this podcast. I would love to show up for you too. It's easy. Just sign up for my free newsletter after the show by visiting lisakefauver.com/newsletter.
And expanding out even bigger, because we're in a moment right now in the world where we are seeing a lot of mass death occurring, like it's coming directly to us.
Yeah.
Now, how do I spread that compassion even further? It is hard.
And it takes that intention. We're paying attention to something all the time. And so bringing intention to your attention, which might include really being mindfully, how do I ripple out this sensation of compassion, is a practice that we can come back to over and over again, too. That's the thing. Our minds will wander, and then we're going to come back to it. And that's beautiful. So we dove in, as per no surprise to nobody, into the deep, big existential conversations. But I want to rewind just a bit to say, here you pivoted. You did this lawyering thing because you thought it touched a little piece of little you that was around advocacy and helping other people. But depression showed up, as you said, as a gift to tell you, there's something bigger, different, better, more aligned, you know, and then Jessica showed up in your life and Peter's experience showed up in your life. Pivoting to becoming a death doula, tell us a little bit about that journey. And even as you fast forward these 10 years, what didn't you know then about what this experience was going to be like? But how did you cross into that threshold of death doula?
After Peter died, I gave myself plenty of time to grieve, but my grief was also informed by this like burning desire in my body, because now I had the tickles about how we die societally from the time with Jessica and then the lived personal experience with Peter. And I was like, this whole thing is fucked. Like, we gotta relook at how we're doing all of this. And so it was really fueled by anger. I was angry. I was angry at the system.
Angry is a motivator. Anger is an emotion that, if we listen, can be really useful, actually.
It can move mountains.
Yeah.
It built a practice.
Yeah.
It built a practice. Anger built this.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. I was pissed. And anger is something that I had not previously really allowed myself, but in grief, it was the one that was leading. Mm-hmm. And so I just kept writing it. And that anger led me to research more and more. What are the options? What are the ways? How do I make it so nobody else has to go through this? What about all the people that are suffering that I can't see, that are going through this exact same thing, that don't have to? There could be another way. There must be. And so I started learning, read a lot of books, called anybody I knew who did anything death-related, talked to my therapist about it, who suggested that I go to this intro program at Sacred Crossings for death midwifery. And I went, and I begged my way in, and bless Olivia, who gave me a chance to come in because the intro session was full. And I was like, I'll bring my own cushion. I'll bring my own water. I won't make a sound. And she was like, are you kidding me? But I was like, please.
I need this. You don't understand.
I need it today. And it was that night. So I went, and yeah, she was funny when she opened the door. She was like, you are so persistent. And I was like, oh girl,
you don't even know the half of it. Yeah.
You don't know. I think she knows now,
yeah.
But at the time she was like, what is up with this child? And it was wonderful. I learned a lot about how to care for bodies after death. I saw a new way to be with death and dying. I heard people talking about things that mm-hmm. I'd not even thought to hint at, but things that were starting to bubble up in my body. And so after that, I just took that learning and supplemented it with accountants and lawyers and alternative funeral homes and hospices and hospice volunteering. I took jobs anywhere somebody could give me one in a death-related field. I got a license to sell life insurance. I just wanted to understand how the whole thing worked.
Yeah.
So I could offer some support to other people. So yeah. I taught myself a big practice area and then started offering it, started making ways for people to engage with their end-of-life planning to ultimately need support when they're dying. And we did that slowly, slowly, slowly. We started offering workshops and some end-of-life planning consultations. I sat bedside. I worked at the alternative funeral home. I had multiple little streams of income all around death-related fields.
Yeah.
First of all, I just couldn't get enough. I was so curious about it all the time.
Yeah.
But next, it felt like necessary for me to learn how to do all of it. And yeah. also, I needed to pay my bills somehow because I was not going back to the practice of law.
Yeah.
And I still had student loan bills. I still have student loan bills.
Well,
that's an aside.
Conversation for another day. Yeah.
There's a whole
another
other
systemic
podcast.
Failure in this.
Whole
one of the
podcast.
Many systemic. Yeah. Anyway.
Truly. Yeah. So I patched together a career and kept going and kept going. And before long, word was spreading and I was making more money and I was feeling a little bit more certain of what I was doing. One of the things that I did not know then was that I'd have to be running a business. That was a surprise to me. And really the worst and hardest part of all of this work. People always think, oh, it must be so sad. You must be grieving so much. People are dying all the time. I say, hey, thank God, nothing on taxes. Okay.
Right.
Nothing on trying to figure out business structure and job descriptions and like, where's the money coming from? How are we going to pay for this? What do we need to do there? Like running a business is tough.
Adulting. That's what I call adulting. Everything that has to do with adulting in that way is absolutely the bane of my existence. And people say that to me all the time, too. I mean, I was a social worker, worked in foster care, adoption, public housing, cancer, you know, like I've worked in already. So, but when I shifted to become what I call a grief activist and to do this work 5 years ago, everybody was so worried about the heaviness and the weight. And I was like, this work, like you, lights me up from the inside. I feel so much appreciation and joy and awe and wonder. The only thing that gets me down is that I also am my website designer and I'm also my tax preparation person. And people would be surprised. I mean, you are looking at my company. Like, it's the business part of the work is. So adulting is tough, but by the way, I'd still do it 10 times over. And I imagine 100
times
too,
over.
Right.
But 100 times over.
It does pull you away from, I think, maybe sort of, you know, what you're here to do. So you've done all these different little things and I'm relating so much. I dabble in a lot of different things. Is there a piece of the sort of work that encapsulates your role of a death doula at this moment anyways, could be a different answer in a few years, that feels especially alive for you or especially like this is what you're meant to be doing, whether it's teaching or being with people? Or is there one or two things that are sparking?
Teaching, being able to talk about death. And when I say teaching, I mean rather creating the space so people can teach themselves. In the Going with Grace End of Life training course, we brought together a bunch of information. It's a 14-week online and in-person modules, but we gather the information, but it's really the experiential part of it.
Yeah.
It's the exercises. It's the, hey, try this out, see how it feels, come back and let us know what you learned. And watching the connections people make, what they do with the work themselves, how they heal in their own lives, how they heal their relationships, how they start to think about their bodies and their planning and all that stuff is so rad. And then once they take it out into the world and the changes that they're able to make is, I mean, there's like no better feeling than to talk for a while with somebody who took the course at some point that has built something that feels really good, or were able to support their grandfather in their death, or was able to like make space for their neighborhood to honor this tree that died, you know, like
whatever it is.
It's really rad. All the public education about it is really, really cool too. I met Dr. BJ Miller. Are you familiar with him?
Yeah, I had him on the show a couple seasons ago.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
he's BJ.
Phenomenal human being.
Love.
Yeah.
I met him probably about 7 years or so ago. And I talked to him just very excitedly about what I was up to. And he just paused and looked at me. He said, you know what? You just did one-on-one. You can do that one on 20. You could do that one on 200. You could do that one on 2,000. Yeah. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Got it. I was scared, didn't want to do it, but it made sense. And so we did. So teaching and education are the things that still really light me up. I still love to be with families when I can, but I don't have as much time anymore.
Yeah.
That makes me sad. But I also still get to ride on planes and talk about the work that I'm doing and have a lovely conversation about Judaism and sitting Shiva with a guy who came to check out my roof earlier today, you know?
Well, and that's the thing is it's not just in the work when... I mean, this is my sense about you, again, from reading your work and from the time we've gotten to spend together in person, too, is that this isn't like, unlike for some people, you go to work, you're an accountant, you do your accountant, and then you're home. You are you wherever you go. And this work comes through you when you, even when it's the guy coming to talk about your plumbing or the roof or the waitress at the, that you get to really show up in the world with all of your enthusiasm and with all of your curiosity and with all of your compassion, even when you're not on the clock.
One thing about doula work is I feel like the personal is professional.
Yeah.
You know, at some point I have to learn how to create some boundaries so I can go on vacation. Yeah. But still, even on vacation, I'm still talking to the waiter about death. Yeah. What I was going to say was that if even not talking about death, being able to be in life and be like in my life.
Yeah.
I think that ultimately serves as an example to other people. I always want to live a life of service. I can do that if I'm doing nails, if I'm making plastic water bottles for a living. As long as I am in my life, I'm clear about what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, and I can still find the joy and the miracle out of being alive.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to, as we come towards the close of version one of this conversation, because I can imagine there will be many more, I hope. You started to speak on this notion of like, this work is a reminder of your aliveness, right? Like, as opposed to being the bummer, it's like, it can be the spark that happens wherever you go, and to be looking towards and being reflective around this thing that will come the end that will come for all of us to really live. I'd love to just read back to you one last passage again, one of the many that I sticky noted, but it speaks to this. And then maybe just hear a little bit about what's bringing you aliveness these days and what's kind of next on your radar. But I think this was maybe the last, spoiler alert, no, just kidding. It's the last page of your book before your epilogue. But this last chapter you said, and it just, for life's sake, don't die with a freezer full of bananas. Make the banana bread, scream into the pillow, take a nap, eat the cake, forgive yourself. Buy the shoes, apologize to the people you've hurt, watch the birds make a nest, tell the truth, tell the ones you love that you love them, fuck a lot, and make love. Quit the job or take the job, whatever it is that you know you must do to reconcile your life with your death. Do it today, and don't stop until you get enough. I mean, I feel like that's a t-shirt I could just wear and walk around with all day. Loved it. It just resonated so deeply. How do you live with that on a day? I mean, we're not always walking around in that. We got to pay, as you said, we got to pay the bills. We got to take care of the kid. We got to do the right. The sort of monotony or the responsibilities of adulting can get in our way so easily. And yet I think we lean on that often as a crutch in a way. So how do we, you could answer it both ways, live more at least into that way of being in the world? How do we live into our aliveness more? How do you?
What helps is practicing presence. You know, just every once in a while when I can remember, just to like put my feet on the ground and wiggle my toes in there and be like, whoa, this is really cool. Going outside, because I'm on the computer a lot or talking or in these conversations, just going outside and looking around at the natural world, seeing the lemons on the tree, looking at their color, how rich that is, and thinking about how they fall and they decay and they feed the earth below it. And it's just this beautiful cycle that does not require any input from me. And it's absolute perfection. All that stuff helps me just get really, really present to the magic that it is to actually be alive.
Yeah.
Because it is magic.
It really is. I mean, that's where we started our conversation. So it seems like a really beautiful place to end our conversation today. It is all magic and it's aliveness. And even the hard things, even the illness. I mean, as I know you're just recovering something. I'm, you know, through surgery and 12 weeks of chemo and a month of radiation and immunotherapy. And it's been a hell of a year. And even in that, we can find this aliveness, this magic, this rich. And I think it's actually turning towards awe. And there's data out there when you think of like Dachner Keltner's work and others, that turning towards magic, turning towards awe, turning towards wonder, even and especially in the hard things, actually alleviates some of that unnecessary suffering that we carry with us when we carry the story and the weight, you know, of the hard thing. I went and sat over the Pacific Ocean. I'm lucky enough to live now in Southern California. Before every week, before my 3.5-4 hour chemo sessions that just about took me down to my knees, and just sitting for those 10 minutes before I got in the car and drove to the hospital every week, I really think made a difference. Did the chemo still suck? Yes, it fucking did. And I think there was a level of magic that I got to carry in my body that kind of was like this, I don't know, protection or something. It was just like, it was this safe bubble. So we can be with the magic even in the hard things. To this point of the thing, you don't have to wait till it's all good to appreciate what's around you and to, right?
Yeah. And also, you know, something that reminds me or keeps me in the aliveness often is when I am in a hard thing, remembering that even feeling the hard thing is a gift, because there was a time in depression when I couldn't feel anything. And so I'm grateful when I'm feeling frustrated or I'm feeling sad or I'm feeling angry. And then the second thing is that one day I won't be able to feel anything because I'll be dead. That reminds me of the aliveness even in the hard.
Yeah. I can't add anything more profound than that. So for now, I'm going to say goodbye. And thank you to Alua for joining me on Grief as a Sneaky Bitch podcast. Magic. It was magic.
Magic. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Oh, my friends, in listening back to today's episode, I remembered how much more we both had to say. So perhaps and hopefully this won't be the last time you hear from Ailua on the podcast. In the meantime, you can watch her inspiring Endwell talk and her incredible TED talk at the link in my show notes for today's episode. Her extraordinary memoir, Briefly Perfectly Human, hits bookstores April 16th. You are absolutely going to want to pick up a copy. I devoured her book in 2 days. It was that good. Thank you so much for listening to our conversation today. If you found it helpful, don't forget to share this episode with others who might need it too. If you do it on socials, don't forget to tag me at Lisa Kefauver, MSW. And of course, if you loved it, leave a 5-star rating and write a review wherever you listen to this show. Oh, and this season, I've even committed to releasing the unedited video version of these episodes on my new YouTube channel at Lisa Kefauver, MSW. Thanks to Mike Moody at Record ATX for the audio engineering support and Gail Smith of Alafia Sounds for providing the music. Until next time, my friends, I see you, I hear you, and I'm holding you in my heart.